citizens. The deeper question, Rizinow sank back, the ornate chair that was once Orso's creaking under his bulk, to consider the gilded dome above. Is what are we now? Orso considered that one of the best questions of recent times. A few tiles were cracked, a few benches broken, and one of the glorious stained glass windows had been smashed and badly boarded up, so a chilly draught occasionally swept through the hall. But otherwise, the Lord's Round was much as it had been. They called it the Commons Round now, though. They'd turned the cushions over so the embroidered Sons of the Union didn't show, and the unruly gathering who sat upon them was no longer the Open Council, but the Assembly of Representatives. There had been votes in the districts of Adua, apparently. Votes from every Middleland-born man, no matter how mean and ignorant, resulting in a body of representatives, as far as Orso could tell, every bit as mean and ignorant as they were. Votes. He could only imagine his mother's reaction to that. The tyranny of the majority. Representatives would be elected in other cities of the Union in due course, but those benches were still empty, while the Assembly argued over the rules. They argued even more than the Open Council had, if that was possible. They argued every point. They argued the order of the points. They argued the method of argument. "What are we?" one of Rizinow's cronies pronounced with great emphasis. "Or what should we be?" Everything was said with great emphasis. The most banal observations became profound revelations, tear-tracked protestations, chest-thumping declarations. "A republic?" "How?" Someone frowned towards Orso. He looked vaguely familiar, impressive whiskers. "We still have a king." "A regrettable state of affairs." Orso could not tell who had said that. Probably everyone thought it. He had long been thinking it himself, after all. He was not at all sure why the Breakers had not done away with him on the day of the great change. Perhaps they could not quite shrug off some vestige of deference to the monarch. Perhaps they thought his presence might lend proceedings a patina of legitimacy. Perhaps they preferred him as a contemptible prop than a martyr to be avenged. More likely, they feared to smash the past all in one go, and were holding him back for a spectacular finale. Whatever the reasons, they had built an absurd little enclosure to contain the royal person, halfway between a theatre box and a dock for the accused, splattered in cheap gilt already peeling. He felt like the ridiculous peacock some southern ambassador had once given his mother. She had kept it in a silver cage as a curio for visitors. It had looked deeply unhappy, produced an astonishing quantity of dung, and not lived very long. It would have helped, at least a little, if all the old denizens of the Open Council had lost their places in the great change, but a smattering of Orso's worst enemies had managed to cling to their seats. Lord Isher had slithered from hiding, Lord Huygen had slipped out of prison, and the young lion sat in the front row, along with several other surviving aristocratic rebels. Those few noblemen who had stayed loyal to the crown were languishing in cells beneath the House of Truth. The world was turned upside down indeed. Traitors were patriots, turncoats were loyalists, corruption was purity, and the truth a lie. Aside from the reduced Lord Brock, there were no delegates from Angland. Lady Finry was back in charge there, carefully considering her options. Starrickland was not represented either. Lord Governor Scold had denounced the great change, and, if Orso knew his brother-in-law at all, would even now be wondering how he could twist it to his advantage. The only representatives from beyond the shores of Middleland were a few alarmed aldermen of Westport, no doubt regretting their decision to remain inside the Union more with every passing day. also wondered absently if he might get a message via them to his mother and sister in Sapani, just to let them know he was well. Reassuring lies had always been the glue that held his family together, after all. "The Union is and has always been a monarchy," came Rizenau's endlessly overemphasizing voice. Chairman Rizenau, he was calling himself, appropriate for a man forever sitting down. "We must acknowledge the past, even as we shape the future. But we are a new variety of monarchy and must devise new terminology." Nothing pleased him more than to tinker with terminology. The man was a positive manufactory of verbiage. "You might call it a representative, or perhaps a constitutional monarchy." Among the newly elected there were labourers, merchants, printers, lensmakers, clockmakers, candlemakers, even a couple of maids and a belligerent laundress, but also a disproportionate number of artists, poets, and that most nebulous of designations, intellectuals. Rizenau clearly considered himself to be artist, poet, and intellectual combined, though in his labyrinthine speeches also perceived little artistry, only the cheapest kind of poetry, and no intellect whatsoever. "I have been considering a written constitution." Whiskers again, leaning over the parchments on the high table, pen in inky hand. It finally came to also who he was. Spillian Swarbrick, that bloody writer in whose office he used to meet Savine. In spite of everything, the memory brought a rare smile to his face. "I was thinking something along the lines of, we consider these facts to be self-evident." There was instant opposition from among the great thinkers. "What? Nothing is self-evident. Pretentious, presumptuous. Asking for trouble. Terrible first line." There was the scrape of a nib crossing out. "Thorny, isn't it, once you start drafting? Not at all like fiction." Judge delivered one of her explosive snorts of scorn. She was draped over a chair with one bare foot up on the high table, its dirty sole directed at the chairman, her lip permanently twisted and her eyes forever narrowed. Her followers, the burners, had taken to dyeing parts of their clothes red. You could see a few of them on the benches, red hats, red sleeves, red trouser legs, as if they had been dipped in blood. Perhaps they had. "Let us skip over the first line for now." "The first line? And already we're skipping over? Don't writers always say you should write the first line last? Just the sort of bloody rubbish writers would say." This was the way of it. Business was steered by Rizenau's whims or whoever could shout loudest. Halfway through discussing one thing, they'd be dragged onto another. It was the most dispiriting display of mismanagement Orso had witnessed, indeed, since the last time he sat in this room before the great change. He leaned sideways, holding out his goblet. "Don't suppose you could fill me up again, Hildy?" The day the Agreant fell, she had melted into the crowd as ordered, then melted straight back when he was not immediately torn to pieces. He had admonished her sternly for her disobedience, but in truth was pathetically grateful for this one undeserved shred of loyalty. They had confiscated her old cap, leading to a flood of swearing which had still not quite dried up, but otherwise allowed her to stay in post, wearing an absurd livery. This was typical of the new regime. Some things they furiously tore down, others they let stand, even tearfully celebrated, all without apparent pattern or purpose. "You sure?" she muttered through tight lips. "Worried they'll take a dislike to my drinking? They took enough of a dislike to me already to overthrow the monarchy. They've given me wine. Bad wine, but still. Might as well make use of it. His eyes met Corporal Tunney's for a moment, slumped upon a bench towards the back. It hurt also more than it should have to see his old standard-bearer seated among his enemies. But one can hardly expect paid hangers-on to keep hanging on after the pay dries up, and it could not be denied that no one better represented the faithlessness, degradation, and low character of the commons than Corporal Tunney. Swarbrick droned on. If we accept, just for the time being, temporarily and reversibly, that we do consider these facts to be self-evident, there was an expectant pause, which facts should they be? Ah! Rizenau placed a finger on his lips and considered the dome once again. Well, that would be the deeper question. Orso sank into his chair with a groan, letting his gaze wander lazily along the front row. Only one man there met his eye. The young lion looked neither young nor particularly leonine any more, his face hollowed out and lined with pain, beard scattered with still-healing scars on the left side, one of them dragging his mouth into a permanent half-frown. Orso raised his goblet in a silent toast. Why waste energy on hatred, after all? The world in which they had been rivals had dropped into oblivion beneath them like a sunken ship. They all were treading water to survive. Leo sat there in agony, the cold throb through his ruined arm and into his shoulder, the salty sting where his teeth were missing, the endless ache in the foot he no longer had, the tormenting itch in the butchered stump. By the dead, he mouthed, squirming in his seat. He wanted to rip open his sewn-shut trouser leg and tear at the red wounds with his nails, gnaw at the stitches, like a wolf might at a leg caught in a trap. He squeezed his eyes shut, trying to breathe, trying to listen, but he could hardly follow a word. The crowd bellowed and warbled along with the blood rushing in his ears, no more meaning in it than in a stormy sea. He was a crippled shell, a tortured ghost. He'd never be himself again. You all right? Asked Huygen. Leo got as near a smile as he could, a skull's rictus. Fine. He'd never been much of a liar, but this must have been one of his very worst. If I was in your position, drawled Isha, I'd be straight out of this madhouse and back to Angland as fast as my legs could carry me. He realized his dire choice of words. On the next tide, I mean to say. Savine's due any day, grunted Leo. Be a while till she can make the voyage. Even speaking was painful. But Commissioner Pike's invited us to stay, meaning we're still prisoners. I think he's got people watching us. He has people watching everyone with a Dan in their name, murmured Isha. He has us watching each other. Huygen glanced suspiciously about the surrounding benches. Better value for money.
Gentlemen, if I may, someone shouted. Citizens,
someone roared back.
Citizens, of course. My profuse apologies.
The man looked terrified. There was a feeling that little mistakes were being noted down and would soon enough be counted against you.
I wish to speak of the walls, the city walls, the walls of the Agrient. They are, practically speaking, an impediment to the growth of the city. They are, symbolically, a reminder of monarchist oppression.
Isha sprang up. The man could move fast when he wanted to, scurrying from the Battle of Stauffenbeck, for instance, or scurrying back once he saw something to gain.
They're damn useful for the defence of the city, though.
Leo thought he might be roughing up the clipped accent of the Midland nobleman to sound more like a commoner. There'll be foreign enemies, jealous of our freedoms. There'll be enemies in the provinces, keen to take us back into the past."
Isha pointed across at Orso, watching this performance with weary scorn.
"There'll be enemies among us, wanting to raise a king above our heads again."
"Those who've snatched power always fear it'll be snatched away." There were murmurs of agreement, nods rippling through the benches. The public gallery was less enthusiastic, though. Not so much the message, Leo reckoned, as the messenger.
"Aristocrats!" someone bellowed from above. "Clinging to aristocratic symbols!"
Insults were thrown down, and scraps of food and crumpled pamphlets, and the king acknowledged them by raising his goblet and taking a lazy swallow.
"What does the young lion say?" "Let's hear from Brock."
Rizinow banged on the table for order, and Leo flinched. The sound made him think of the cannon blast in Stauffenbeck, the shattered guild hall, his horse falling across him, Antaup with bloody hands in his lap, gin riddled with flatbow bolts. He tried to wipe his face, greasy with cold sweat.
"You should say something,"
muttered Isha, frowning up towards the jeering gallery. The thought of standing terrified him, but there must still have been some stubborn remnant of the young lion hidden deep inside. "Better to do it than live with the fear of it," the dogman used to say. Leo might have lost a leg and an arm, but he'd show these bastards he still had his heart. Eugen hauled him up, while Isha wedged his crutch under his arm. Then they sat back, applauding his pluck. Not the man he was, he'll never be the man he was, but the crippled curiosity can still raise a cheer or two. Leg trembling, stump burning, Leo drew himself up, raised his chin, bellowed at the echoing hall, the way he'd once bellowed at the cavalry of Angland, working them up to a charge.
"Citizens, we've changed the world. A great change."
For the massively worse in his case, but he heard applause, or he hoped it was applause, and not just the blood rushing in his splitting head.
"But there's still so much to do."
Sweat tickled his scalp, trickled down his forehead. He paused to catch his breath, to think through the pain. All his life he'd been fixed on what he wanted to say, never given a thought to what they wanted to hear before.
"Walls won't protect us now, only unity."
By the dead, the hall was swimming.
"Those who've enjoyed great privileges must make great sacrifices."
They needed some noble gesture. He bared his teeth.
"So I give up the Dan in my name. I renounce it. I cut it out. We must all be equal."
No doubt it was clapping now, and lots of it. Folk were standing. Someone was shouting "the young lion" over and over. It took Leo an age to turn around, good leg quivering, aching hand sticky with sweat on his crutch. Isha, Huygen, and the rest of the lords looked more than a bit queasy.
"I'm sure my comrades, who once sat on the open council, will all happily do the same. I, for one,"
he gathered himself for a final effort, roared it at the dome in a broken voice,
"cannot think of a title that makes me prouder than citizen."
Furious applause and the thudding of boots from the public gallery seemed to merge with his thudding heartbeat, the pulsing pain in the stump of his leg. He could hardly make out Rizinow's words.
"The assembly no doubt wishes to thank the young lion for his sacrifices on behalf of the great change. It is an inspiration to us all that he has so soon overcome his wounds and returned to the service of the nation. Let the walls of the Agriont be demolished. There is no need for we in power to separate ourselves from the people." Rizenau thumped the table with his chubby fist.
We are the people!
More cheering, one more hopping, lurching step, and Leo collapsed onto the front bench. Isha caught him under the arm, clapped him on the back, waving to the public gallery. Through his fixed smile, he hissed furiously,
We did not agree to this. You will.
Leo didn't care a shit about that coward's discomfort. He'd too much of his own to deal with.
When you've lost an arm and a leg, he snarled,
gripping at his throbbing stump,
a piece of your name doesn't seem such a sacrifice.
Broad stood there where he swore he'd never be again in uniform. They called him Captain Broad now, if you could bloody believe it. He wondered what Liddy would have made of that. Asked him what the hell he thought he was doing, most likely. He wished he'd got an answer. He hadn't asked for it, hadn't even agreed to it. But he hadn't stopped it either.
Symbols have power!
It was that bloody writer Swarbrick, near foaming at the mouth with passion.
And the statues on the Kingsway are the most powerful symbols of all. Must the representatives of the people pass every day below the very feet of such oppressors as Harald the Great or the Magus Baias? Why, I would sooner lay down my life, lay it down on the gallows where so many martyrs were slain by the Inquisition, than see it continue for another day.
Citizen Swarbrick wants to set the people free,
murmured Brint, who by some magic had gone within weeks from Lord Marshal in the old regime to imprisoned traitor to general in the People's Army. Those kinds of wild falls and rises were everywhere in Adua these days. Broad thought of Valbec, the streets strewn with rubbish, the mobs and the fires, wallpaper being boiled for soup.
Folk want bread, he said. Then safety, then shelter. Freedom's far down the list, and principles far behind that. Perhaps you should be a representative.
Broad raised his brows at the benches. There were some good folk on them, honest folk with good ideas and good intentions. Shame they could hardly get a word in. The first day the assembly sat, there'd been this moment when they all swore an oath to serve the people, then applauded loud enough to shake the dome and threw their hats in the air. Some bastard's cap was still snagged on a bit of carving just below the gallery. Broad had been sure then that things would get better, better for everyone. But before the end of the session, things were turning sour. Even when they could agree on what the people wanted, they couldn't agree on how to get there. Ever since, they'd been mired like a wagon with a horse at each corner. Broad folded his arms over the breastplate they'd given him.
I've a shitty enough job as it is, General, thanks all the same.
Good man must stick together, said Brint. Try to contain this madness.
If that was the aim, it looked to Broad like they'd already failed.
Can't make you any promises.
Best you don't. No one's keeping the damn things anyway.
We should dismantle the House of the Maker.
A man with a huge beard was squawking out, shaking a great sheaf of papers. His plans for the future, maybe? There was no shortage of those.
It's a regressive symbol.
The House of the Maker ain't our problem,
roared a great big fellow with an anchor tattooed on his cheek.
Or the statues, or the bloody walls.
He took a great breath, nostrils flaring.
It's the fucking foreigners!
Broad winced. Everyone was furious all the time. Everyone looking for someone to blame. Everything teetering on the brink of violence. He felt like he had hysteria in the war. A clenched fist itching to strike. And the worst thing about it, he wasn't sure he didn't like the feeling.
Citizens, please, we must stand together,
A bony fellow with a shock of wild white hair had jumped up, something desperate in his voice that made everyone fall silent.
"I have been administering charity in the Three Farms for these past 12 years, and I swear to you things have never been worse, never."
Some nods from the more ragged members of the Commons, some rolled eyes among the noblemen.
"We have wrested the reins of power from the closed council. I applaud it. They dragged our nation towards the abyss. But the granaries are emptier than they have ever been. Coal is in scarce supply. The injustices that led to this upheaval, the want, the scarcity, the degradation, the disease, they will not simply vanish because we remodel some statues. All the signs point to a harsh winter on the way. We must prepare, citizens. We must be ready."
Broad found he was nodding along, but the noise in the hall was mounting again, jeers and cheers together. The old man's voice was failing, and Swarbrick sprang up to thunder over him.
"Prepare, of course, but we must not indulge in defeatism. We must not encourage a dangerous nostalgia for happier times that never were. I would rather lay down my life than see this proud assembly cavil, nag, and naysay. We must not talk the nation down. Before we can feed the people's bellies," agreed Rizenau, "we must feed the people's minds. Only with a government founded on sound principles of fairness and justice can they prosper."
As the old man dropped spent into his seat, the rest of the representatives were rising to applaud their chairman. They did that a lot. Broad clenched his fists tighter and glanced towards Judge, flopped loose in her chair, with her head resting on the back, scratching gently at her stretched-out throat. With something stuck between horror and excitement, he realized she was looking right back at him. He remembered being chained to a chair with her in his lap, crotch grinding against his, and he felt that guilty tickle deep inside. He remembered her grinning face spotted with blood when he split that banker's skull, and he felt that tickle even worse, even better. A little smile quivered at the corner of her mouth, as if she guessed everything he was thinking. Some men can't help themselves.
"I have a point to raise."
As the representative sat back down, one man was left standing in the aisle. Ordinary looking, in travel-stained clothes, a walking staff in one hand. Rizenau peered up at him.
"I do not recognize you, citizen. What district do you represent?"
"Oh, this is Master Sulphur."
The king tried to swig from his goblet, frowned, upended it, and shook a couple of drips into his lap. Then he turned his lazy eyes towards the benches.
"He represents the first of the Magi."
That got a murmur from the assembly and from the gallery, too. Broad raised a brow at Brint. The general could only shrug. Not much would have surprised any of them now. If a dragon had risen from the benches, it would likely have been calmly dismissed on a point of order.
"My master Byers is gravely concerned by recent events," called Sulphur. "In the Union he founded, in the city he built."
He gestured towards Orso, who was sitting back and holding out his goblet for a refill.
"To the king he crowned." "Do thank your master for his concern," replied Rizenau, "but tell him he should keep it for himself."
Laughter at that, and an approving banging of fists on benches.
"The free people of the Union have no further need of his meddling."
Sulphur's eyes narrowed.
"How soon you all forget. It was within your lifetimes that he saved Adua from the terrors of the Eaters." by destroying half the city and causing the deaths of thousands, called Rizanow. Bias saved us from the eaters, perhaps, but one wonders, who will save us from Bias?
More laughter and more anger, and Rizanow flashed that prim little smile.
General Brint, could you see our visitor out? The age of wizards is over, Master Sulfur. An age of reason has dawned.
Reason?
Sulfur glanced about the benches and gave a hiss of disgust.
I'd like to see it.
And he stalked off up the aisle, staff tapping against the steps. Before he'd even reached the doors, someone else was bellowing to be heard.
I demand we reopen the question of whether we should be called the Assembly of Representatives. I would like to propose colloquium.
A chorus of groans.
Again?